We'll just wait till they get out. All right.
Good morning, and may it please the court, Charles Scarborough for the FBI. The timely and full reporting of potential security risks plays an essential role in the overall process of maintaining the national security. Executive Order 12968 thus imposes a duty on all agency employees with access to classified information to report any information that even raises doubts about whether another person's continued access to such information is, quote, clearly consistent with the national security.
But you agree the executive order does distinguish between who reports and who makes the
Absolutely, Your
judgment.
Honor. But our fundamental point here is that the executive order clearly does delegate a security-related decision-making authority to all employees who hold classified clearances, and to do the very thing that is, you know, purported to be challenged in this case. Our point is that because the front-end decision to report the possible security issues involves the same kind of predictive judgment about security risks as the back-end decision whether to deny or revoke a security clearance, EGAN equally shields that reporting decision from judicial review, and that by requiring all employees with security clearances to report potential security issues, the executive order confirms that all of those employees, not just those in sort of a particular unit of the agency, have the necessary training and expertise to exercise predictive judgment of the sort.
Of course, one of your arguments is that employees are required to report anything, even if they just have a suspicion. They're not. You make a very powerful point in your petition for rehearing that you don't want these people investigating on their own. When in doubt, report. And that doesn't require any expertise at all.
Well, Your Honor,
isn't that right? I mean, that's what you want. And I understand that argument, but that sort of undermines your argument that everybody in the whole FBI is properly trained to do this sort of thing.
Well, clearly, as an employee, you're always exercising some judgment. I mean, you're not going to just report any old thing. You're obviously, and I think this case illustrates the point, Donovan Layton wrestled with the decision to raise these security issues for a long time. He consulted with other people about that, with his superiors in OIO, and that's just sort of reflects the reality of the reporting obligation. It's a fragile thing that you're trying to encourage in the executive order. Employees are often unwilling to step forward. Again, this case sort of illustrates the problem when you step forward.
Let's not, you characterize it as wrestling and employees are reluctant to step forward. I mean, I just want to focus on this case.
Sure.
All right, because that's what we're dealing with. And here you have a situation where Mr. Layton was assigned to conduct an investigation. Then he reported his investigation.
I don't agree with that characterization.
He went
over to Riyadh on a temporary duty assignment for 3 weeks, and he then observed many of these things that raised the concerns. Again, understand, Your Honor, the context here, and it's important. I'm not trying to be melodramatic. This is immediately after 9/11. This is the post in Saudi Arabia, and we're dealing with the person who is the primary contact with the Saudi intelligence service, the primary contact for the FBI, dealing with coordinating with them. There is a massive influx of personnel, these TDY personnel that are frequently referenced in the briefs, who are going over there on temporary duty because they have a lot of leads to investigate, because most of the 9/11 terrorists came from Saudi Arabia. So there's a lot of work to do over there. Layton was part of that group that went over there. When he went over there, he observed and heard things that caused him security concerns. He came back. He took a vacation, and he then, in his interactions from his post in D.C., observed more things that caused him concerns, and eventually decided, I have to bring these issues to somebody's attention. And then he wrote the electronic communication that is at issue in this case.
Let me ask you this question. Assume, for purpose of my question, that you've convinced me that our original opinion in this case was overbroad, that you're right, that you can't have it just can't work. If the liability turns on negligence or recklessness, okay? Assume you've convinced me about that.
I'm happy to do that.
Okay. What, talk then about narrowing the exception for retaliation cases to situations where the reporting employee knowingly filed false information.
Certainly, Your Honor. Can I ask a further question so I understand the hypothetical? Are we talking about just cases in which ultimately the security clearance process has resulted in no revocation, or are we talking about sort of all cases?
No, just this case. Let's just talk about this case.
Okay.
Where security clearance was not revoked, and let's just make it really simple. Suppose the only allegation in here were from the retaliation complaint was that that said I'm not raising any questions about judgments about what kind of information should be submitted, what shouldn't. My only claim is Rattigan's only claim is that what Layton filed was knowingly false.
Sure. My initial response is that there's nothing in Egan or any Egan case that I know of that hinges the applicability of Egan on the severity of the allegations.
No. All right. Then I have to say,
all right,
I have to add a second element to my hypothetical. Okay. That, number one, that you convinced me that the recklessness standard was, or the negligence standard was wrong. But number two, you haven't convinced me that Egan goes beyond the security division. Okay?
Okay.
Two parts to my hypothetical.
Okay, so we're drawing...
We're not talking about Egan. We're talking about your argument that I thought was very persuasive in the petition for rehearing, that if we're not careful here, we could chill employees reporting valuable information that the security division needs to know. Okay, that's what I'm talking about.
Okay.
And my question is, what's the problem if we limit this to filing knowingly false information?
Well, as an initial matter, and sort of the dispute that you have, the evidentiary dispute that you have in this case, shows how easy it is to allege knowing falsity. And what ultimately, I think the problem is, it's the same administrability problem that you would have with the reckless standard.
But why is that?
Because that's basically the template for plaintiffs to follow if they want to avoid Egan. They say,
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Okay. And again, we've actually seen this in some administrative cases already, where you're going to, as a matter of course, if you have an Egan problem, allege knowing falsity. And then what happens? That has to be tested. That's very easy to allege. It has to be tested in some way.
But the only question is whether it was false. There's no question at all about whether this was information that the security division needed to know or should have been reported. The only question is whether it was false. Absolutely. That's the only issue.
But, Your Honor, case illustrates, the way that plays out as a practical matter, and the dispute that we're having on the evidence on this case as to whether there is evidence of knowing falsity plays out essentially as a mini-trial on the merits of the allegations.
I'm not sure that's right. I mean, take, for example, the charge that his charge that these nurses were, that the word nurse was euphemism for prostitute, okay? Now, obviously, I get your point that, you know, if someone's in a security sensitive position is going to prostitutes, that's something the security division needs to know, right? I got that. But But in my hypothetical, the only issue is whether the person who submitted the information knew it was false. That's all.
I understand, Your Honor.
And obviously, the Security Division doesn't want people submitting information they know is false, correct?
That's correct, but the Security Division equally does not want the people going around trying to independently verify the information. Can I respond to the specific point that you made about the nurse's point? Because I think it rests on a sort of a false premise about what the EC actually said. Again, I really urge the court to go and look at that carefully. I've spent a long time doing that. But I can tell that from your brief. Issues reported, they're not allegations so much as these are things that people told me when I was in Riyadh. And specifically, I want to quote, because you brought up the issue of nurses and prostitutes. There are many things in that AC that are just undisputably factually true.
I agree with you.
And the only question is sort of what security inference. You're right. Going to the nurses issue there, the EC addresses this at Appendix 499. And says that this suggested, I'm quoting here, suggested to Layton that the term nurses was being used by Legat Radigan as a euphemism for prostitutes. Yeah,
but
that is far from
Radigan's claim in his brief. He says in his brief, look, I was dating this woman. I was dating her openly in Riyadh, going to parties with her. People in the office knew I was dating her, knew she wasn't a prostitute. And if that's true, then his point is that Layton's statement that he heard this from other people could be false.
I understand, Your Honor, but Layton's statement was not limited to Mr. Radigan's wife in any way. And again, this is where a close reading, you really have to get down into the weeds on these things. And Layton's EC really is replete with a sort of a reporting of both sides of the issue. Right. I mean, again, on Appendix 500, he talks about the Saudi garb and what inferences he drew from that. He thought it was unusual. He talked to other people who thought it was unusual. And then he has a sentence that says, in fairness to Radigan, other people didn't think it was unusual, and they thought it advanced his relationship. Uh-huh. These were not the kinds of allegations, things that someone bent on, just making up lies about Radigan would make.
Tatel's hypothetical as he gave it to you, though. Layton knows, all right,
but
Radigan, the person he's dating, is not a prostitute.
Layton
right,
doesn't.
That's the allegation.
I understand, but there's no evidence that Layton knew any of that.
But you want to try the case. We're back at what may the plaintiff claim without being thrown out of court under Egan.
I understand, Your Honor, but I think my point is that you have to try the case to figure out whether there is a valid claim of knowing falsity that could somehow circumvent Egan. And so any plaintiff faced with an Egan problem is going to allege that, and then you have to try the case.
All right, but that's sort of the fear of any litigation. You know, anybody can allege anything. Judges throw these cases out daily. What we're talking about is somebody who survives those threshold motions. All right. Now, is there still an Egan problem?
But I guess, Your Honor, my point is that Egan and the cases that we've cited, Pinoak and Becerra and Hill, all those cases had the same allegations, that the supervisor made false allegations against me, and that initiated the investigation, and that resulted in the revocation of my clearance. They have those allegations in all those cases, and it's a strange system to say that we're going to allow allegations of knowing falsity to make a carve-out from Egan only in the circumstance where it didn't ultimately result in the revocation.
Well, that's your reading of Egan. And my reading of the executive order is saying the agency head is supposed to designate the people with the special training who are going to exercise this predictive judgment. All right? And they, Egan, have to have a lot of leeway for making mistakes. We're back at step one.
Well, Honor, Your Honor,
you make a knowingly false statement against a coworker.
Again, I thought you were focused on the relative training and expertise of the different people. So, in other words,
no, I'm not. I'm just trying to get you to focus on that, not mix the two.
In other words,
I read your brief is anybody who says anything about anybody, there is no relief for a plaintiff. under Title VII?
I don't think that's a fair reading of our position.
Okay. What is left? Tell me what kind of case can proceed under your reading of the executive order.
Well, again, the executive order, in response to the training point, the point that we've tried to make is that you can't draw lines based on relative expertise.
My question now is, what kind of case can proceed?
I don't want to bid against myself on what can potentially...
But that's precisely why we're having this hearing, not to bid against yourself, but to get some subtle judgments and sophisticated judgments here. It's very easy for this court to say, well, nobody can do anything, period. National security. All right? But that's not the way the courts have looked at these cases.
Well, Your Honor,
and the way I read your brief was to say that if somebody who has a security clearance sends anything over, that's the end of the matter. There is no litigation to proceed under Title VII.
Yes, if the type of decision that they are engaged in, yes. That's
the
correct, Your
Honor. Closed entirely, and so I want to know what's open in your view.
I'm not going to be able to identify anything that is open.
All right, so that's what I thought your brief was. There are no cases.
I'm not backing away from...
No, but clearly, that's why we had those three questions.
Sure.
All right? Does the Department of Justice think that any type of Title VII cause of action can proceed without coming into the realm of EGAN?
Question is so broad. I think what our position...
No, it's not so broad because you had our original opinion, and as Judge Tatel said, you made some persuasive points, all right? And the question is, well, is there anything left?
Well,
and
so,
your briefs, the way I read them, says there's nothing left.
Well, I think it depends on the nature of the thing that is occurring, and that's what EGAN focuses on, is the nature of the decision. Is it the type of decision that involves some form of predictive judgment about security risk? In this case, that is clearly the case. And the way we know that is because of the executive order and because the referral was made pursuant to that and raised security issues.
Mr. Scarborough, let me try to get my question differently, because you're going back to your EGAN argument. Let me try to get it a different way. One of the things you say in your brief, and you told us this before, is that, hey, look, we have internal procedures to deal with people who knowingly file false information, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Well, first of all, what are those? You don't cite any, and I couldn't find any. What are they?
Well, just curious. They're the same. First of all, any sort of, if you were found to have knowingly falsified information in a written communication, yeah, you could be referred for discipline to, in the FBI, it would be the equivalent of the OPR.
Yes.
They call it the inspection division. Uh-huh. You could be right up back before the security division yourself, because any sort of honesty concern obviously raises questions about your ability to hold a security clearance. That didn't happen in this case. It's very clear that even though the security division, you know, reached a different conclusion about the security risks, there was no investigation or, you know, further discipline against Donovan Layton.
You know, one of the investigators actually recommended that, right?
Yep. I don't believe that's the correct term.
Is it? She said this is all very suspicious, it needs to be looked at.
She stated, I think is the fairest reading of the record, that there seemed to be tension between Mr. Rattigan and the Home Office. She did not. And again, this is something that if the security division had found, they would have been obligated to make a referral to take further action.
Now, how would that have been any more chilling than this case?
In other words, suppose
the department had decided it was pretty suspicious about these allegations, particularly about the charges about prostitutes, so we're going to investigate Layton to see whether he knowingly filed false information. How would that be any more chilling to the process than this case?
Well, I think there's a couple of different ways. Mm-hmm. First of all, in an internal investigation, you would be presumably applying the clearly consistent standard, not a preponderance of evidence standard applicable in a civil case. Itself recognizes.
No, wait. You keep drifting back. Well, remember, my question is focused only on one question, not whether EGAN should or should not have submitted, given information about whether Rattigan was hanging out with prostitutes. That's not the question that would be dealt with in the internal agency investigation. The question would be, did he knowingly lie about that? That would be the only question. And if the government can undertake an investigation like that of Layton, or any of them, let's just keep him out of it. If the government can undertake such an investigation, I have no doubt that it can. I don't understand why a retaliation claim in a Title VII case focused only on whether the employee lied would be any more chilling. That's what I don't get.
Okay. And my response, again, is twofold. One has to do with the institutional competence of the internal reviewer and how sufficiently attuned they would be to the wide margin of error that is necessarily...
I don't mean to interrupt you. Well, I do mean to interrupt you. Because there isn't a question of a margin of error built into my hypothetical. It isn't a question of whether he should have submitted, whether he should have said, gee, I doubt, I'm not sure about this, but I should submit the information. Right? I got you about that.
Right.
You've convinced me, hypothetically. But the only question in my hypothetical is, did Layton lie?
So
there's no question of a margin of error at all. And and your argument is that that's chilling, and I don't understand why this is any more chilling than an internal agency investigation.
Let me try again with talking about preponderance evidence. It has to do with the difference between an outside entity reviewing this, a judge or a jury, many, many years after the fact, and someone who is familiar with these standards. I'm not going to talk about
what
the standards.
The standard is, did the guy lie or not?
But
there's
Your Honor,
no other standard at issue in my question.
But again, as the evidence in this case makes clear, did the guy lie can be characterized in all kinds of different ways. You can make allegations that the guy lied at sort of any stage, and a judge or a jury is more likely to be receptive to those.
Why? Wait, what do you mean by that? That I don't get at all. I mean, judges and juries, if there's one thing judges and juries are, or one of the many things, I should say, that judges and juries are extraordinarily good at, is distinguishing between people who are lying and not lying. That's what they do most of the time. And you've heard me say that I was very impressed with your argument about the excessive breadth of the panel opinion. And I also understand that in these areas, we owe an awful lot of deference to the executive's judgment about these national security questions. And I'm prepared, and I understand that we owe that deference across the board. So what I'm looking from the government here is an argument as to why it is that this narrow exception we're talking about would also be chilling. And that's what I haven't heard so far. And I asked you about the internal investigation to sort of tease it out. That's what I'm looking for here. So
again, speaking to the chill point,
I don't
want to keep coming back to this, but the difference between being reviewed as the reporting employee by, you know, in a confidential process within the FBI that's investigating you for potentially lying, and, you know, being publicly paraded around as a liar, and in this case as a person with serious alcohol problems, those are seriously different.
Couldn't an employee be charged under the False Statements Act for filing something like this?
I suppose so.
Sure.
I suppose that's possible, Your Honor, but you asked about internal constraints here and internal processes, and I'm trying to be responsive to the hypothetical at long last. I think the point is...
So the point is then that, okay, this is an internal procedure. It doesn't have the public aspects to it. He's not being charged publicly with lying.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that what your argument turns on?
Well, that's
one burden, too, right?
It's the burden. It's the public humiliation. It's also things like, and plaintiff alludes to this, the No Fear Act. If you are a person, an employee of an agency who does something that gives rise to Title VII liability, you are in line for lots of extra punishment there. There are all kinds of extra things that kick into play mm-hmm. and make it more chilling to have review by what the Egan Court, and I know you don't want to hear about that, said is an outside non-expert body as opposed to the internal people who deal with these issues all the time. The other thing I would point out is the timing issue here. Mm-hmm. The internal procedures presumably happened pretty quickly. In this case, the internal investigation was conducted, over a matter of months. You know, civil litigation goes on for years and years. We're talking about stuff that happened, yeah. 10 years ago
okay,
at this
so
point.
So we've got timing. We've got the publicity part of that, right? The burden. Okay. Oh, by the way, are there any examples? Do you cite any examples where anybody has been disciplined? We looked for such cases and couldn't find any.
Well, I think that just speaks to how unusual this case is.
Uh-huh. But you can't cite a case where an employee was investigated and disciplined for lying.
No, I do not have one. And again, I think that speaks to how unusual it is to have someone suing where the security clearance wasn't ultimately revoked.
Yeah.
This is a highly unusual procedural posture that we're in.
Well, it's very hard to show that someone who gave incorrect information was knowingly giving incorrect information.
That's correct, Your Honor, but we don't even think that the evidence in this case...
That cuts both ways here. It goes to Judge Tatel's point, I suppose, that this is a narrow
right.
carve-out, although that proving, because you never know,
right.
you almost never have a window
Absolutely.
Into someone's mind at the time they made the
Absolutely.
Statement, you're proving it through the same process that you prove that it was reckless. Right. Or
And in response to Judge Tatel, I was trying to limit myself to just the types uh-huh. of chill that would be worse from an external body as opposed to an internal body. But it goes back to an administrability concern. Even though knowingly false sounds like a very discreet, cabined inquiry, uh-huh. this case shows how it's not. And this Egan happens usually, or it should happen, at the threshold of a case. Here we have, a trial has occurred, and we're still having the same fact-intensive dispute about whether there was knowing falsity or not.
Remember that the government took 5 years to raise.
I understand, Your Honor.
All right, so
I understand, Your Honor.
I'm making
a general point.
All right. But the point that has to be taken into account is that Congress has made a decision that certain types of conduct is actionable, and the president's order is not inconsistent, in my view at any rate, with the notion that the Supreme Court looked to this special expertise that was going to make this predictive judgment. So that's why I said, is there anything left to Title VII under your analysis? And I think that's why we're just interested to see what is left. And I was trying to think of an analogy where, there could be a smoking gun that would demonstrate knowing falsity. I mean, it's not inconceivable. But the question I'm more interested in is, are they thrown out at the point they file their complaint?
I understand, Your Honor, and I think our point is that if this court, which, obviously lots of people follow it and understand that this would be an important Egan ruling. If this court were to make a carve-out for reporting, uniquely for reporting and uniquely for knowingly false reporting, you will see that allegation in every single case. It will be
right.
a template.
That's the floodgates argument. And I think in terms of publicity, at least the record here shows that a lot of people knew about Layton's problems. All right, so,
Again, we make the point simply to show the problems of publicity, and it's
and
it is a.
And let's say also that these internal investigations involve burdens too. I mean, employees' jobs are on the line.
Yes, Your Honor.
And these days, they're likely going to hire counsel to help them through the process. So this is not some friendly, meeting. This is try to save your job.
I understand, Your Honor. I don't mean to any way dismiss the internal constraints. That's one of the things that we have obviously put forward as, a reason why there is sort of no compelling policy reason to carve out. And in our view, it's a carving out from Egan of the reporting function for knowing falsity.
The compelling policy reason was made by Congress, all right? It's not the court.
I'm not sure that's true, Your Honor.
No, Congress clearly said certain types of conduct are actionable, and it had a carve-out for national security, and then Egan comes along and says, well, you don't want these non-expert judges second-guessing these predictive expert judgments.
That's our point. Egan came along and said that, gave an umbrella for certain conduct.
I don't think you're, I mean, I understand your argument about the internal procedures, but I don't think you can say that that means there's no reason for doing this, for allowing a Title VII case to go forward in this narrow category of cases, because in the internal procedures, the injured plaintiff, the person who is the victim of the knowingly false accusation, gets no remedy.
I'm not saying that there's presumably, I'm not saying that there's no reason. Right. I'm saying that it's in some respects, the reporting, the false reporting, is an area that is the least susceptible to abuse, because by definition, you have a second layer of review. You're reporting to someone who is going to review it, figure out what the correct answer is.
Doesn't that suggest that also it's likely to be not very, it's pretty hard to argue that it's chilling, that, you know, it rarely happens, and, you know, people, government employees, I mean, I'm sure they're trained I'm sure they know they're not supposed to lie in the process.
I agree, Your Honor. I'm not in any way suggesting that this is a frequent occurrence. But I'm suggesting that it would be a frequent allegation in Egan cases.
Right.
I mean, it would be always a
frequent allegation, and I took your point to be, and hard to screen out at the threshold, because you can't tell from just the allegation or even initial pleadings and depositions, whatever,
that's
someone's lying. So you have to go all the way to the end to trial.
That's correct. And that's, so it's one of the many administrability concerns.
The allegation is kind of a gateway to a trial, and that's a big burden, and therefore that in turn is a chill. That's your theory, or am I?
That's absolutely our argument, Your Honor.
Of course, the trial.
And stated more succinctly and better than I have been able to thus far.
Of course, the ultimate trial would only be on the narrow question of whether the employee lied.
But again, Your Honor, I mean, we then bump into all kinds of the other issues of trying to segregate out the reporting decision from this, you know, the security decision.
That's why we have jury instructions. Juries are always instructed on.
I understand, Your Honor, but again, this very case, to the extent that the court was contemplating a remand, demonstrates the problem here, that if you were to remand, and we don't think, of course, there is any basis for doing that, to try the referral, the security division itself at Appendix 382 said the OIO guys did the right thing by referring this matter. And so you have segregability problems all over the place.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Why don't we hear counsel for appellee?
Thank you, Your Honor. I think you're absolutely right on when you in your question, Judge Rogers, about what is the limit here. I think there, if you accept the government's argument in this case, there is no limit. You know, basically, they want blanket immunity. Whenever there's a report that somebody is a security risk, if it arises in the context of a adverse employment decision, the government would give that person absolute immunity, or itself absolute immunity, from any challenge to that. I don't think that's what Egan stands for. I think Egan was, I mean, you have to go back to Egan. I think Egan says there are three.
You agree that the immunity goes to the initiation of an investigation, though?
Well, I think.
And to the revocation.
I think to the extent that there is immunity for this kind of activity, you have to look at Egan to determine where that would come. Only where you have a situation where a court is being asked to review the substance of the security clearance decision, and based upon looking at the conduct of those personnel within an agency, and there are people, whether it's a special division or the head of an agency or whatever it may be, there's somebody in every agency, to the extent that there's a security issue, who has responsibility for that. You have to look at the conduct of those persons who are appropriately trained, adjudicated personnel who are making predictive judgments. None of that happened here in this case.
My only point was that we all agree there's some immunity. The question is how broadly it extends.
I think there's immunity to the extent to which...
Second point is that it's not really immunity in the constitutional sense. It's Congress can override the immunity at any time.
Well, I understand it, but it's no different than, say, giving a prosecutor absolute immunity for their decisions taken in their prosecutorial capacity. It's the same thing, but it's a broader immunity than even prosecutors have, because in certain functions that they engage in, there's only qualified immunity. But I don't think you even get to the question of what of the immunity unless you satisfy Egan's basic, which I believe is at the core of Egan, which is if the initial reporting, and here it wasn't just Layton who was making the initial reporting, it was an entire OIO, the Office of International Operations Management. So it's a little bit unfair to just focus on Layton. It was Mr. Radigan's management who made this referral. If the initial reporting does not undermine the substance of the security clearance decision, which it doesn't here, well, I think Egan would say that conduct would not be covered by Egan. I think that's the basic principle you take from Egan and the progeny.
The reason we reheard this case is because of the government's argument that even if Egan is limited to the security division, mm-hmm. that because of the requirements for reporting, i.e., when in doubt, report, that the problem with our panel opinion is that it would not only chill reporting, but it would get the court into deciding, you know, whether somebody had negligently reported or recklessly reported. Employees might react to the opinion by checking things out before they report, which the government says is exactly what they don't want to happen. So, I mean, you know, that setting aside the Egan argument, that's what precipitated this rehearing here, was the government's argument that our first cut at this case was chilling, and we do owe a significant amount of deference to the government on judgments like this. I mean, obviously we can't try it, but, you know, so what do we do with that?
I mean, I agree that there in certain situations there is deference to the government. I think when there's a security clearance is denied, or when looking at the initial reporting implicates or undermines the ultimate security clearance, that deference is owed. This issue was brought before Judge Huvel at the last minute, and they said Egan precludes you going forward. This claim is not justiciable. She looked at it over the weekend, and she concluded that it wasn't, based upon her analysis of Egan. I don't think this court should be really in the business of fashioning a totally new rule, which would be any time there's an allegation that there's an allegation of a security risk in the context of a Title VII case, that somehow all that conduct gets swept away and is not justiciable, is immune from anybody looking at it.
I understand that's your position. And,
well, I think
and that was my position the first time around also. But what I'm asking you is, what's your best argument? And I told you what troubled me about this was the government's argument that, you know, this could be seriously chilling to the process. And, you know, look, the petition for rehearing was filed, it was approved by the Solicitor General of the United States. It says in it that they consulted a number of agencies. Mm-hmm. It seemed to me that those are the kinds of things a court in the national security field should take seriously. And what I'm asking you is, what's your best argument for why I shouldn't worry about that?
I'm sorry to hear the last part.
Your best argument for why, notwithstanding what the government has said about the chilling effect, and I'm setting aside here an exception for knowingly filing false information, which I'll ask you about separately.
But setting aside that category.
Yeah, setting aside that category. I mean, you know, how do you convince us that?
I don't buy the, it's, I think it's essentially.
No, you don't buy it, but Tell
us why.
Well,
let me say why I don't buy that. I think the courts and juries are, as you said, Judge Tatel earlier, are perfectly capable of ferreting out whether there's a legitimate claim or not. The courts often act in the context of summary judgment, a motion to dismiss, to ferret these out. I think in the context of security clearance decisions.
I asked my question. My question was focused only on an exception for knowingly filing false information, for lying. I wasn't talking about the broader issue.
Well,
I mean, let's just take an example. The government mentions the Hansen case in its brief. Okay?
I didn't hear the question.
The Hansen case, you know, the FBI spy?
Yes.
And their point is, look, you know, people needed to know, if there were rumors that this guy was supporting a stripper on his DS-12 salary, right? Government, we needed to know that. And what we didn't want was to have employees going around and investigating that before they filed it. If they heard it and they didn't have some other reason to think it was false, the government needed to know that and know it right now. And their argument is that under our opinion, people are gonna maybe think twice before they file a report because they might fear a lawsuit.
Well, first of all, they personally have no fear of the lawsuit. It would be a lawsuit against the government, and so there's no personal liability.
But they're being charged with violating Title VII by retaliating against someone.
Our nation has made a commitment to equal justice and equal employment in the workplace.
That's why the merits panel opinion came out the way it did.
No, I understand, Judge,
I'm trying to get at why. Take the Hansen case. So one argument you've given me is, okay, they won't be chilled because there's no personal liability. Any others?
Well, I think Title VII itself carves out an exception that says we're not going to look at terminate. The court can't consider terminations that are based on the denial or revocation of a security clearance. That's specifically in Title VII. So the Congress has specifically spoken to the areas in which they will carve out the ability for plaintiff litigants to go into court and allege retaliation. I agree that this is a somewhat unique case, and I think the fact that it arose in the context of not a denial or a revocation, but where they actually upheld Mr. Rattigan's security clearance and found every allegation made by Mr. Layton unfounded. Everyone.
Why aren't you grabbing on to Judge Tatel's suggestion that in this limited category he's discussing with you, an employee also faces the possibility of a false claim act?
I'm sorry, I didn't have that list.
A false claim act case. I mean, there are other ways that litigants can proceed against employees who have security.
You mean a litigant like Mr. Rattigan?
No, I mean, the concern I thought here was that from the government saying that if we allow these Title VII cases to go form in any shape, form whatsoever, government employees will be chilled because they'll be afraid of publicity, the burden, the length of time that they'll have to be litigating this. Well, there are other forms of litigation too where employees can be sued.
Well, I think the answer is that courts are often called upon to balance certain rights. If you look at, for instance, in the police misconduct field, a malicious prosecution. Well, you can't go forward with a malicious prosecution unless you show a favorable termination on the merits. So you can't willy-nilly challenge any act by a police officer. There's the same kind of prudential concerns that exist in those cases about not second-guessing the decision of a police officer to do this. Or look at Heck v. Humphrey, which is where the Supreme Court says you can't bring a 1983 claim challenged in the underlying basis of a criminal conviction if that conviction hasn't been reversed. I mean, courts are often called upon to balance rights.
I thought your larger answer to Judge Tatel's question about the executive concern was a separation of powers kind of answer, that this is for Congress to account for, and for Congress to carve out an exception, not for the courts. Is that
well? I think that's right, Judge Kavanaugh. I think,
and we know that Congress can do so because it's done.
It
many,
did it in Title VII
it's
already.
Done many exceptions right. for national security arena, and
I don't think that helps your case.
No, it's just Congress has spoken.
Right, this doesn't help
it
your case.
Has said there is a carve out for terminations,
right. Whether
but other
a revocation
than that,
or denial.
Other right. than that, the litigation can go forward. So the government doesn't make that argument.
Well,
very
I'm saying,
careful. The government's argument is this executive order.
I understand, but I don't think the executive order can be held to trump a congressional scheme created in Title VII to deal with the issues of discrimination in employment. And they've spoken about that. And I think, and to the extent that the Supreme Court has spoken on this issue, they did in Egan. And the situation in Egan is not the facts in this case. The facts in this case had nothing to do with reviewing the underlying basis for the substance, if you will, the actual substance of what the Security Division was looking at. It didn't look at the people that we weren't concerned about those personnel who were designated or could be considered to be the appropriately trained adjudicated personnel who make the kind of predictive judgment with respect to national security. I mean, the mere fact that the government raises national security. And by the way, I have to say, it wasn't raised until the very end of the right on the eve of trial. Up until
that doesn't matter at this point.
Well, yeah, it matters in one way. It matters in one very important way, Judge. It matters up until the less than 30 days before trial. Donovan Layton's position was that he never referred this matter to the Security Division, that it was an employee assistance issue that he was concerned about Rattigan. It was his management that turned it into a security issue. And, I mean, this is, but you have to look at the record. In the trial, they came up with an affidavit on the eve of trial saying, well, I forgot. That really was about security. It wasn't about employee assistance, and that's what I intended to do all along. And there were, on the stand, he was impeached with his four prior statements saying it was all about employee assistance and had nothing to do with his concern about whether Rattigan was a threat to the national.
Can I ask you if the exception were limited to knowing falsity?
Well,
how would a case be thrown out at the threshold on the at a motion to dismiss stage, do you think?
I think it would. I don't know that you could do it on a motion to dismiss, to be honest, Judge. I think you would have to look at it in terms of you have to deal with it almost like a qualified immunity situation where the courts have allowed appeals from a district court decision to a court or not a court qualified immunity. And allowed interlocutory appeal of that. I think it would be at the summary judgment stage. I think the knowingly false exception would save Rattigan in this case. I think there's abundant evidence in the record that the OIO management knew that these allegations were false.
Yeah. What is
that evidence?
Why don't you talk a little more about that? Right.
First of all. If you look at the sequence of events, the proximity in time between the allegations of discrimination and Layton coming and starting to write his EC and then eventually being...
Well, all that just means that you may be able to prove retaliatory motive. The question is, what's the evidence that his allegations about...
They knew...
Many of the things he charged him were totally true, right? That he wore Saudi clothing... Yeah. That he went on the Hajj, all those are fact. You're not contesting any of that.
Well, it's not that fact that's at issue.
Okay.
It's whether that fact suggests something in terms of whether he's a security risk. And they knew that there was no, that fact didn't could not be the basis for a security risk because they knew about it. It was in their magazine. He reported it. He reported the gift to his agency. They knew about it. They knew that his wife was a nurse, not a prostitute. They
now,
had 50 or 60
that?
TDY personnel.
Talk about that for a minute. So, what? How do? Layton says he heard, quote, I don't have the exact quote, what is it? Others, quote, suggested that these nurses were prostitutes.
There are no others, and he never testified there were any others. In fact, there were 50.
Any what?
Any other people who would have suggested that there was this scheme to by Rattigan to provide prostitutes to people working over there. There were 50 or 60 people, TDY personnel, as the government says, who went through that station in a very short period of time, none of whom made any kind of reporting of that. They knew that it wasn't false. If it was such concern to Mr. Layton, why didn't he report it as soon as he found out? Why did he wait? Why did he come back and go on vacation? I mean, you have to look at all the facts. They knew he wasn't mismanaging the...
Wait, what's the significance of waiting? Did Rattigan file his complaint after late? There's no allegation.
No. Rattigan had initiated the EEO process before Layton arrived, and it was as that process was heating up, as Pizmuka and...
You're not saying, by the way, there's enough evidence for us to decide.
You're
not saying there was enough evidence. Are you saying there's enough evidence in the record now for us to decide?
I do, Judge.
Really?
I don't think it's even appropriate here to do a remand for the trial. The government got the benefit of the best possible scenario by being able to put on these security division people to say, oh, this was perfectly appropriate, even though the ultimate decision was unfounded. Any new trial, if we follow at least some of the standards set forth in the prior decision by this court, they wouldn't even have the benefit of being able to use Schubert or Bullock. They're stuck with the people in OIO.
Yeah, but when this case was tried, and this is a hypothetical I'm about to ask you, okay? So don't argue, don't resist my hypothetical. But if we decide that a case can go forward only on the grounds of knowingly false information, that wasn't the way this case was tried.
That was what the jury considered, Judge. Uh-huh. The jury heard the evidence about the Sadigar. They heard the evidence about the nurses. They heard the evidence.
The jury didn't have to find that Layton lied to rule for your client.
Well,
right?
they have to make a decision. Who's telling the truth? I mean, Layton's saying I made a good faith.
So even if Layton, I mean, the question was, did Layton have a? They had to make a decision about Layton's retaliatory motive, right?
Yeah, they had to make a decision about whether Layton was reporting accurately. They had to make a decision about whether Pizmuka was being honest.
But he could have had a retaliatory motive even if he was negligent.
I'm sorry, Judge?
He could have had a retaliatory motive even if he was just negligent or reckless in his reporting.
He could, but we're talking not just about Layton. That's why you can't just focus on Layton. You have to look at the fact that his immediate supervisor had just been in Riyadh and it said everything's fine with respect to his running of the office, another allegation that Layton made.
Okay. So what's your answer to the government's argument that, look, even a narrow exception for, I don't think we should call it an exception because it really isn't an exception, but even a narrow, even retaliation claims based on knowingly filing false information will be chilling.
Well, I think my argument, my answer would be good. Donovan Layton should have been chilled here. I mean,
well, see,
I mean
answer
if
is,
you look at all these allegations, 18 means, pages of single spaced, and everything was unfounded by the security division.
Your argument is that's a good argument if what they're chilled from is lying. But if what they're chilled from is reporting, even when in doubt, that's the government's argument. See?
Judge, I don't know that you can come up with
it. You try a lot of these cases. I mean, you know, suppose it was limited to, I know you don't try a lot of Title VII cases based on the limitation of knowingly false, but you try a lot of cases. Could a case be tried that just limited to that? I mean, the question is not whether, you know, the question wouldn't be, somebody wearing Saudi clothing is or is not relevant to a security clearance, or even somebody visiting prostitutes is or is not relevant. The only question is whether he lied.
Assuming The other standards in Egan have been satisfied, that there's no, you're not reviewing the substance of any.
Yeah, nothing. Just.
It's just, once you've cleared those jurisdictional hurdles, you're looking at whether, it's only about whether the person who's complaining, and here it wasn't just Layton, by the way, the person complaining knowingly lied when they made their referral. I think that's too narrow.
I know you do, but.
I think that you can, as we did in this case, you depose the witnesses. They give certain versions of what happened at one time, and then when they get on the stand, they contradict themselves. Mm-hmm. Juries are often always asked to make a decision about credibility. It's one of the things they're instructed on. You believe a witness or you don't believe a witness. It's not an exceptional kind of process you're asking juries to do, and I think that it would be a tragedy in this case if we had to go back and retry it again, because the jury heard all the evidence about all this information.
But see, juries, it's the jury that has to decide whether someone's lying, not us.
Right, and the jury already did that.
The instructions, there's nothing in the instructions that said that you could only find the government liable under Title VII here if Layton and the others lied, is there?
No, but no, there's no instruction like that.
Of course not.
But there is an instruction that talks about evaluating the credibility of witnesses.
Right, exactly. And the question is, I assume what the jury was looking at here was, did Layton do this in order to retaliate against?
It wasn't against Layton who was retaliating.
Well, I mean, all
Layton
of them.
Was the vehicle for the
all
retaliation.
You understand? I'm sorry, I didn't say that right. But right, it was the question of whether there was retaliatory motive. That's the question.
And I think there's abundant evidence in the record from which you can infer that. And that's let me just say one thing there was a question raised.
Yeah. Sorry, go ahead.
There was a finding that everything was unfounded. Cheryl Tucker, who did the investigation, did say, I mean, she had real concerns about what was going on here. Nobody in the FBI did anything about that. Nobody looked at that. I mean, Mr. Layton was a very complicated person.
If I say to you, I heard from A that B was visiting prostitutes, you could say that charge was unfounded because there's no evidence for it. But that's not the same to say that I was lying, that I heard it from someone else.
No, that's right.
Unfounded doesn't
get you. But in the Title VII retaliation context, if you satisfy all the other elements of showing a retaliation claim, the fact that there's a contest about whether he lied or not is not all that startling. I mean, and I don't think you should limit it to only the circumstances where it's based on knowingly false information. Although in this case, I think we more than established that.
Okay. All right.
Thank you, Judge.
Counsel. Counsel for appellant, would you like a minute or two?
Sure. Since we ended with the unfounded portion, again, I think we've made the point in our brief that what was unfounded, what the security division determined, was the security risks, the inferences of security risks. There were many, many things, many facts reported that are just flat out undisputed, and we've gone through them, and I won't go through them again, but I listened very carefully. I didn't hear any actual factual assertion disputed, much less any evidence presented that anything was knowingly false. And for that reason alone, even if this court were of the mind that there should be a knowingly false carve-out, there shouldn't be a remand in this case. This case should end now. There's an additional reason why this case should end now, and we've briefed it thoroughly, and I don't want to bore the court if you don't want to hear it, but it's the failure to do a cross-appeal.
But you didn't raise that in your petition for rehearing. And, if it's in the petition for rehearing, it was that gave us the questions we asked you, and you didn't raise that.
I understand, Your Honor. We're simply pointing out that the case was tried with the materially adverse action being the initiation of the security investigation, and plaintiff did not. I mean, in some respects, it's a jurisdictional question. I mean, the Freeman case makes that clear. If you're trying to enlarge and go off on a different theory,
in fairness, the trial started one way, and then the government came in with this new theory. All right?
What's the new theory?
You raised all. the Egan.
Well, we raised Egan before trial, admittedly very late before
the
trial.
The district court wrote an opinion.
Yes.
All right? You can't deny it.
Yes.
All right? So the case went forward on one theory. Then the government comes in on this other theory, and the plaintiff still won. All right? So now the government's appealing. All right? Unless you have anything more that you haven't already said, let's just
I'll leave that alone. It's submitted to the court. I wanted to talk, Judge Tatel, you've been asked a lot of questions about chill and the comparative chill of the internal constraints versus or the internal processes versus the external processes. And one thing that's frequently mentioned is the possibility of criminal prosecution for false statement and how that might equally be a very serious chill. I think an important distinction there from civil liability in a civil suit is that, of course, the executive controls that. So to the extent that we're talking about separation of powers concerns, that's sort of in a different place.
Well, you're not suggesting, are you, that because the executive controls it, that it's less likely to happen?
No, Your Honor, but I'm suggesting that the executive is again, the entity to whom these judgments are assigned.
Why is that? Just tell me once more why.
Again,
relevant to just my narrow exception. Why is that relevant to that?
Because in an assessment, a global assessment of knowing falsity, I think the evaluation occurs very differently when it's an executive branch decision maker who understands that you want to report even things like rumors, like the Robert Hansen example.
If something's false, it's false.
I understand that, Your Honor, but the point is not simply at the end determination that something's false is false. I agree with you, obviously. I can't dispute that. It's the process of getting there that is messy and problematic and causes great administrability problems. So we urge the court to reverse and dismiss the case. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. We will take the case under advisement. Everyone can go. I'm sorry. I'm just trying to save something on my laptop. Thank you.
Hopefully, we won't see you next December.